Hello and welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 234. My name is Terry Frost, and this time around we're looking at a couple of film noirish melodramas from the 30s and 40s. First off, there's a Humphrey Bogart movie not many people have seen called Black Legion from 1937. Then we move on to a film noir of which I was unaware until very recently. It's a 1946 very small budget monogram movie called Decoy, which is really interesting for several reasons. So sit back, I'll get the contact details out of the way, and we can noir our little hearts out. Paleo Cinema Podcast is a fortnightly podcast of movie appreciation. There's only one rule, and that is the movies have to be more than 20 years old, and I have to like them. I'm going to be looking at the history of the films, the social context in which the films were made, and relate that to the way movies are now. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can also go to feedbackpaleo, P-A-L-E-O, at gmail.com and drop an email or a voicemail by MP3. Or you can go to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. Now, please be aware that this podcast may contain adult language. So if you don't want to have to explain it to your kids, don't listen to it when the kids are around. Unless you have incredibly hip children. Okay, so how's everybody been? It's cooler here, of course. The weather's getting cooler, which I'd never, ever like, as we all know. But I have been doing a few things. So I've been wandering around, caught up with a few people, and started a new venture, in a sense. I'm vlogging. Now, if you don't know what vlogging is, just pause the podcast for a moment, Google it and come back. So I went to the Clunes Book Festival, which is an annual thing up in a country town called Clunes, northwest of here. It's about 120 kilometres away. By the way, this is the reason why the podcast is a little late, and I apologise for that. So I decided I was going to vlog things and put them up on the YouTube channel. And so I got my little not-quite GoPro action camera and blue tacked it to the dashboard of the car so I could get some footage of driving up there. I have a little Lumix, Panasonic Lumix camera, which does some nice footage. I have a really good Google Pixel phone, which does some nice footage. I also have my DSLR, my Nikon DSLR, which also takes nice footage. And between everything, I went up there and bought some books. I spent about, maybe $90 on movie reference books mostly, and got up there about the 8:45 in the morning. It opened at 9, but they let me in early because the people at the gate were nice, and I wandered around. I took lots and lots of B-roll footage and lots of footage of the bookshops and the book displays in the town. It was foggy and a bit cool, so it was all very cinematic, so I really enjoyed that part of it. Caught up with a couple of people briefly, friends Kirsten and Jason, who were in town for the book festival. They're both writers, so I saw them briefly, and got out by about 10:30, 11 o'clock, before the crowd started turning up, which was kind of nice. So I took a lot of footage. I took some footage with the Lumix strapped to the dashboard of the car by a bit of blue tack of the drive back. I took the scenic route back, which is through a town. You go from Clunes to a town called Dalesford, and it's got some nice, curvy, good country driving roads. So I've got some footage of that. And the only thing I've got to do is do the unboxing of the books I've got and get a bit of footage of what I bought and what I think about the books that I bought. So I did all of that on Sunday and got home for a late lunch. The interesting thing, and that kind of exhausted me because I drove 240 kilometres. I did a lot of photography and videoing and got back again. So I was too tired to do the podcast. And then yesterday things came up, so I couldn't do it yesterday. And so I'm doing it today. Here's the problem. I've got to kind of channel my inner Thelma Schoonmaker because I have 80 bits of video. And it'll be 81 by the time I do the here's what I bought kind of part of it. So I've got 81 bits of video to put together into some kind of coherent sequence. Some of them are quite long because there's a lot of kind of dashboard cam footage there. And this is the first time I've tried anything this ambitious as far as the YouTube channel is concerned, and the first time I've had myself face on camera to do things. I'm not pretty, I'll be honest with you, but I'm doing what I can with this one, and I'm trying the new challenge of vlogging. And so hopefully sometime this week I'll have assembled all of those 81 pieces of video, editing out the dull bits, which are usually going to be me, and got it up on the YouTube channel. So that's a new challenge there. And yesterday, Sally and I went back to the zoo because we have an annual zoo pass, which lets us go to Werribee Open Range Zoo anytime we like. So we decided to take the laptops over there, hang out in the cafe mostly, where there's a glass wall beside the cafe and a meerkat enclosure there. So you can sit down, write things for, in my case, it was scripting for the YouTube channel. I've got about 3 scripts written now. And sitting around, drinking coffee, chilling out, having a croissant, and watching little meerkats play beyond the glass window. And that's kind of cool. So we did that. It's a kind of mental health day thing, chilling out. And fortunately, it wasn't a particularly cold day. And we then decided to treat ourselves to another safari tour where we got to look at the rhinos and camels and giraffes and zebras and all sorts of other animals, which they drive you through in this enormous truck to drive you through the exhibits. So you can get within like 2-3 meters of a rhinoceros, which is kind of cool. So we did all of that again as a kind of something a bit different, getting out of the house, getting things done, and so that was kind of fun. So what have I been watching? Only a few things, really, apart from the 2 movies of which I'm going to speak. I did re-watch Peter Watkins' Punishment Park, 1971 movie, which is a follow-up to his Privilege, where basically dissidents in America in 1971 told that as a part of their sentence for being dissidents, they've got to basically run across a desert while National Guardsmen hunt them. So it's very much of its time, but there's some themes there that are kind of important to remember in the age of Trump. And I know that I talk about the age of Trump a little bit on the podcast, but that kind of militaristic fascism is a theme that it doesn't hurt for us to be reminded about every now and then. It was done in a kind of pseudo-documentary style, which works pretty well. And there are a lot of non-professional actors who were asked to improvise there and express their own political opinions, some of which were quite left-wing, but a disturbing amount of which were very much right-wing. Rewatching that was an interesting experience. It's not a fun movie by any means, but it's also unashamedly didactic. But I did kind of think that it was important for me to rewatch that one, so I watched that. I did also watch one of the Disney animation films that have come out. This one, Suicide Squad: Hell to Pay, which has got the Suicide Squad in it, and it's not very good. There's nothing here we haven't seen previously, really, in the DC animations. There's maybe a little bit of odd nudity. There's a lesbian couple of superheroes in there as well. But for the most part, it didn't really add too much to the DC animated universe, apart from a slight grittiness. But I kind of like the DC animations much more than I like the DC movies. But this one's kind of at the lower end of the spectrum. But while we're on the subject of superhero movies, I did rewatch the 1994 Russell Mulcahy movie of The Shadow with Alec Baldwin, Tim Curry, and John Lone in it. And I kind of like it. It's set in the 1930s, and it's got a period feel about it. It's got Jonathan Winters in it as well. And it is kind of fun to revisit. It's before the current kind of flood of superhero movies, but I kind of like the period piece feel. I like the kind of diesel tech technologies that The Shadow uses, and It's kind of a vulgar pleasure slightly. I don't think it's a fantastic film, but it's one I watch every now and then and enjoy when I watch it, kind of in the same way that you can watch and enjoy a movie like The Rocketeer. So I watch that. Apart from that, haven't watched a terrible amount. I binged a few series on Netflix. I watched the second season of Dear White People, which I like. I also watched the adaptation of Grant Morrison's graphic novel Happy, which is about an ex-cop hitman who suddenly acquires a child's imaginary friend who is a little flying blue unicorn, with a voice by Patton Oswalt. The guy himself is played by Christopher Maloney, and it's a combination of cute imaginary friend and ultra-violence. His daughter, who he didn't know existed, has been kidnapped by a guy who is known as the Very Bad Santa, and the imaginary friend of his young daughter, contacts him and says, "You've got to rescue Haley. She's been captured by this man. I don't know where she is, but you used to be a cop and you need to help me find her." And over the, I think it's 8 or 10 episodes of the series, that's exactly what happens. And there's some comical violence in there. There's some quite nasty violence. It kind of veers between funny and horrifying in an interesting way. And I did enjoy watching that. There's nothing quite like some really fucked up villains, a very, very, very flawed protagonist, and an imaginary blue flying unicorn. Okay, so I'm going to take a break now. When I get back, I'm going to be talking about the 1937 Warner Brothers melodrama Black Legion, starring Humphrey Bogart and Dick Foran, basically loosely based on an offshoot of the KKK, which actually existed in the 1930s. The movie was made in 1937, but filmed in 1936. And at the time, the Black Legion was very much in the news.
We don't take no lip from nobody.
Yeah, that's good stuff. Hit them hard and quick. We ain't afraid of nothing and nobody, are we?
Me cheers for the Black Legion. Come on, what's the matter with
you? Nice joke.
Soldier of the Black Legion, you see before you an instrument of death. We give you this half as a symbol of our trust. The other half you will receive the day you betray that trust.
You've been lying to me.
Don't you call me a liar.
You're Frank. You did have something to do with all those terrible things. You and those new friends of yours.
You shut up about my friends.
I won't. Only a bunch of dirty, contemptible cowards would do a thing like that.
Why, you... They'll kill me for telling you. Them Black Legion guys don't fool.
I'm not fooling either. You're going to quit that game.
I can't get out. Nobody ever lived to get out of the Legion.
Black Legion is a 1937 Warner Brothers melodrama, directed by Archie Mayo, and stars Humphrey Bogart, Dick Foran, Erin O'Brien Moore, and Anne Sheridan in one of her earlier roles. According to Wikipedia, it's a fictionalized treatment of the historic Black Legion in the 1930s in Michigan, a white vigilante group. A third of its members lived in Detroit, which was also the center of the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s. First thing to know about this movie is it's a Humphrey Bogart movie, but it's a Humphrey Bogart movie before Bogart became the Bogart we all know and respect and iconized in things like Casablanca and The Maltese Falcon. This is him playing a character role rather than an anti-hero role. He plays a factory worker called Frank Taylor. He's not an educated guy. He struggles for money. He had some trouble getting some work. And he doesn't seem to have a lot of self-awareness. He's married and has a son and a wife. And at least at the start of the film, he loves them and he works hard to try to make a living and make a future for his family. So all of that stuff is pretty much standard for the era. But there are some flaws in Frank that are opened up by circumstances. First off, he does have that lack of self-awareness. He's not a reflective person, in a sense, and not an educated person. Obviously, he's a factory worker in the 1930s. He's passed over for a promotion he thinks is deserved by a foreign-born friend who really worked hard for the promotion. He recommended some improvements in the factory. He worked hard. He tried to get himself an education. He's moving forward. And he also helps his father out on a chicken farm that his father runs. So this other guy is clearly the better candidate for it. But Frank thinks that seniority is the only thing that matters in this circumstance. And so he gets a certain level of bitterness about the fact that his friend gets the promotion to foreman. The friend's name is Joe Dombrowski. He's played by an actor called Henry Brandon. The fact that he's not American-born causes some resentment in Frank. And one of Frank's co-workers, Cliff Moore, played by Joe Sawyer, who was a character actor who appeared in tons and tons of movies. You'll know his face when you see it. And was also really good friends with John Ford and Ward Bond. So Cliff Moore kind of sees an opportunity here and introduces Frank to the Black Legion. The Legion recruit him and charge him for a Black Legion regalia. They also charge him for the price of a handgun, $14, which is not an inconsiderable amount of money out of the household budget. Reluctantly, Frank goes ahead. And we see a scene a little bit later with the leaders of the Black Legion, who are corporate type guys. They're businessmen running fairly large businesses, and they see the cash flow from the various groups and chapters of the Black Legion, making them an immense amount of money. So in a sense, the people at the top end of the Black Legion are there for the money. They're also there, of course, because they're white supremacists. But for the most part, it seems to be a kind of scheme to get a lot of money from a lot of poor and very ignorant men, which is kind of an interesting approach. It could well have been based on the court transcripts of the trials of various Black Legion members that occurred in 1935, 1936. But the fact that they put it into a movie like this and said that these guys weren't just kind of racial purists with the sole motive of protecting the rights of white Americans and all that kind of thing, but that they're basically greedy bastards who are willing to rip off the poor people even as they use them as their tools for their political purposes. That's kind of an interesting and complex and a nuanced way to approach this kind of stuff in a movie of this type, which I found really interesting. So Frank Taylor and his Black Legion friends go to the chicken farm owned by Joe Dombrowski and his father and burn it to the ground and chase them out of town. That thereby opens up the foreman's job, and Frank gets the foreman's job, which is kind of, and he doesn't seem to have any feeling of guilt about doing it particularly. He's got the job, he can buy the new car for the family, he can buy his wife a vacuum cleaner, and so everything seems to be going well for him for a while, in spite of the fact that he's committed quite a serious crime as a way of getting ahead in the world. Meanwhile, the leaders of the Black Legion are doing a recruitment drive and tell all of the members of the Black Legion they've got to recruit two people to the cause. And so Frank tries to recruit a new guy working in the factory, and in doing so takes him away from his job, and an accident happens which destroys a piece of machinery. Frank's friend Ed Jackson, played by Dick Foran, gets the job, and that starts up a bit of resentment there. Meanwhile, his relationship with his wife Ruth, played by Erin O'Brien Moore, starts suffering because Frank's out late at night at Black Legion meetings and doing the nefarious things that Black Legion people do. He comes home drunk and doesn't want to talk to his wife, and the relationship becomes strained by that because he feels empowered by the fact that the Black Legion's there to right these kind of perceived slights. His moral compass, which was always a little bit wobbly, is totally fucked by this stage. He gets deeper and deeper into the Black Legion stuff until finally he goes past the point at which he can deal with the organization and what he's done. I'm going to do a spoiler, so it's a spoiler from here on out. His friend Ed tries to convince him to quit the Black Legion. He goes and tells him, no, I can't do that. These guys will kill me. They kill people who betray them. And then, almost by accident, he shoots and kills his friend Ed. And then is arrested for murder and goes to trial, where he turns state's evidence on the Black Legion reluctantly after threats are made to him and his family. So ultimately, Frank does the right thing. He basically helps crack the Black Legion, but the price to himself is very high. Interesting thing here is, this is a morally dark character, Frank Taylor. He basically is easily led by people who tell him what he wants to hear. He doesn't have any awareness of his own limitations and what he needs to do to fix them and manage them. He has a great family life, which he pisses away because his own ego demands that he follows through with these people who are telling him what he wants to hear and telling him he's wonderful and telling him these other people are the cause of all these problems. And then when he finally kills his best friend, he decides he's going to turn his back on these people and dob them into the coppers. So he's not an admirable character at all. He's not even a tragic character. He's quite a nasty and stupid person, really. And Bogart does a fantastic job of portraying all of them. The family life stuff at the start, where before he starts getting bitter and twisted, is well done. And the kind of dark journey that Frank Taylor takes through the movie is really well portrayed and well written as well. It's kind of like going to hell one tiny bit at a time. And Frank does that. He really is a morally ambiguous character at best. This was seen as a breakout role for Bogart as well. He spent most of the 1930s as a Warner Brothers character player, just basically doing what they told him to. And he had some hopes after making this movie and really showing his acting chops and showing that he can carry a film of a serious nature like this one. It was still a couple of years away from High Sierra and then, of course, from The Maltese Falcon and the other films that for 18, 19 years made him the Bogart that we all know now and respect. And so this is kind of the first movie on that journey where you see Bogart playing weak and tough at the same time. And he does a really honest job of playing somebody who's fairly unintelligent, very uneducated, and very not self-aware. So all of that stuff's not particularly easy to play, particularly for somebody who's intelligent, as Bogart himself was. Kind of going through those steps and playing the character as written and doing it in such a way that he's really, really believable. Bogart himself wasn't particularly born from a poor family. His family was fairly well-to-do. But he did have that knack of playing working-class heroes and anti-heroes and just general working-class guys really effectively. Later in life, when he played people who were fairly well-off, like in The Barefoot Contessa and also in a movie he was terribly miscast in, Sabrina, it really doesn't feel lived in as the way that the working-class characters that Bogart played really do. There's a kind of honesty about them and an integrity and a believability about his working class characters that made part of that charisma and part of that wonderful iconic persona that we now know Humphrey Bogart to have. Would have been a good political role for Bogart as well in Black Legion because he was definitely a lefty. He protested against the House Un-American Activities Committee in the late 40s, and he was definitely a supporter of FDR's New Deal. And, of course, he worked for Warner Brothers for a number of years, which was seen as the kind of working man's movie studio where they did tell stories of ordinary people and kind of had that grassroots approach to many of the things they did, in contrast, say, with MGM or Paramount or even to a certain extent Columbia, though Columbia was kind of in the same realm as Warner Brothers at the time. And in fact, in 1936, Columbia did a very similar movie based on the Black Legion, historically and from recent news at the time, a movie called Legion of Terror, which starred Bruce Cabot, Marguerite Churchill, and Ward Bond, which very much covered a lot of the same territory. I haven't seen Legion of Terror, but I'm going to have to track down a copy of it, I think, just to kind of compare and contrast it with Black Legion, but Black Legion's probably my favorite Bogart movie before he became famous. I saw this really long time ago on late night TV, which tells you how long ago it was, back in the wonderful days when normal television channels showed old movies late at night. There's a little bit of resurgence of that recently here in Australia. There's a TV station which streams called Seven Flicks, owned by Channel 7, which if you can catch it early in the morning, say, you know, any time between, say, 2 a.m. and 6 a.m., shows old movies like old George Sanders, the Saint movies and the Falcon movies and really obscure 1930s dramas with Richard Dix in them and things like that. So there's still a tiny trace of that surviving on the grassroots free-to-air media landscape here in Australia. But back in the day, there was a lot more of it. And so you could turn, if you were up at late at night, you could turn on the good old-fashioned television, wiggle the rabbit ears, and find old movies like Black Legion. And I remember seeing it at the time and liking it a lot because the nastiness of the Black Legion and the cruelty of it, even when I was relatively unsophisticated and more than a little happy to blame other people for my problems, I could kind of see in this film where that kind of thinking leads. And I think that for people like me, and probably for a lot of us, there are moments in cinema that help us kind of align our own moral compasses. Cautionary tales that we take on board, even kind of subconsciously and to a slight level, which lead us to being better people in the future. And that's one of the nice things about a movie like this. For a start, it's very timely with the appalling and surprising rise of the alt-right in America and in Australia, for that matter, and in the UK and across Europe. And to see this movie from 1937, which makes it, 80 years old now, 81 years old, to see a movie from that age which tells us a lot of the things that are happening right now and tells us that the people at the top end of those malicious organisations are there for the money and the power is quite impressive. It shows us that there are cautionary tales that do stand the test of time. And this one, which wasn't a large budget, or particularly an A picture for Warner Brothers at the time, was made for $235,000, which is hardly anything. But it tells us how greedy racist men manipulate the working class and turn working people against each other. The Dombrowski guy was a fellow worker and a friend of Frank Taylor before Dombrowski got the promotion. And we see some other positive working class characters from non-English speaking backgrounds. There's a scene between Dick Foran and Anne Sheridan in Black Legion where they're sitting in a cafe and they've just seen a movie and they're dating and they're about to get engaged, and there's a kind of cute dialogue there. And the cafe owner comes along and they have a bit of a chat with him. And even though he's kind of an amusing and slightly two-dimensional character, that kind of jocularity and that friendliness and that acceptance of him as a human being is deliberately placed in this movie as a part of that positive rather than negative perception of people from other backgrounds and other cultures. And I kind of like the fact that they put that in there. They didn't necessarily have to do it, but they did it, and they did it with purpose and with a point. Now, the real-life Black Legion is not totally dissimilar to the one portrayed in the movie. It was an offshoot of the KKK, which was at its peak as a paramilitary organization in the 1920s. The Black Legion split off from them and mostly was centered around Ohio and Michigan. The interesting thing about it, too, is that there's a very strong possibility, which was said by the man himself, that Malcolm X's father, Malcolm X, the famous black activist, his father was killed by the Black Legion in the 1930s when Malcolm was quite a young man, or a child, in fact. So Black Legion has had its influence over the years, and it's one of those reminders, too, that cruelty passes through the generations. If something horrible happens because somebody murders somebody else, that affects the family for generations. If there's brutality and family violence in a family, it affects it for generations as well. And that's something we really should remember, that all of that negative stuff, even if it's a cruelty of a politician, we've got a thing going here in Australia at the moment where the unemployment benefits mean that a single person living on unemployment benefits and unable to get a job is living on $40 a day in one of the better economies in the OECD. And so we're having a big discussion in the public forum of media in Australia about the fact that the unemployment benefit needs to be raised dramatically because people can't live on it. They did a study and found out that there were three houses in the whole of the country where people who were living on unemployment benefits could afford to rent a house. Three houses in a country of 25 million people. So in rewatching The Black Legion, just to get back to the point, there are reflections of contemporary concerns in this movie. And that's kind of cool and kind of sad at the same time. The fact that we are fighting the same fights now, and we're fighting very similar enemies, but with immensely enhanced resources, is really tragic and alarming. I mean, the other work from the 1930s that really kind of hammers this point home is a 1935 novel by Sinclair Lewis called It Can't Happen Here, which is about a fascist takeover of America at the top end of things. So basically, a popularist president is elected and starts turning the nation into a corporatist regime. The character in the novel is called Buzz Windrip. The scary thing about it, of course, is that it's probably a bit of a blueprint for Trump. There's actually a couple of stage adaptations of It Can't Happen Here as well. There was one in 1936, which played in 17 states and was part of the Federal Theatre Project, which was a part of the WPA that FDR set up. So anti-fascist plays, adaptations of a novel, were financed by the federal government and shown across the United States. Funny thing, a new stage adaptation was done in September 2016. That is not a coincidence. That, of course, led to the 1960s British movie, a black and white British war film, called It Happened Here, which was made over a number of years and showed Britain what it would be like in the 1960s had Hitler won. And it was filmed on location around Big Ben and the Houses of Parliament over a period of time by some amateur filmmakers. I really have to do that for a future podcast, It Happened Here. But just to sum up Black Legion, it's worth seeing. And if you're a Bogart fan and a Bogart completist, you really do need to check this one out because it doesn't get enough love and it doesn't get enough mention in filmographies of Humphrey Bogart. But I think that it's a timely piece of work for the 21st century, in our particular part of it at least, and you really should check it out. So I'm going to take a break now. I want to get back. I'm going to go with a very dark film noir, Decoy, very low budget, made by Monogram Pictures. Nobody really that you know in it, but it's got some punches to it.
Lloyd, where are you, you fool? Lloyd, here, I found it. I found it, Lloyd. Come on, come and dig it. Come and dig for it. Dig! There it is, in the ground. It's right there beneath you, Lloyd, in the ground. All our hopes, all our plans. They're all right there beneath you. Quickly, Lloyd. Quickly, dig for it. Deeper. Faster. Quickly, Lloyd. They killed for it. They all killed for it. Frankie, Vincent, I killed for it. And you. You too. You killed for it. Get off! Get off! It's mine! It's all mine now! It's mine, I can't! It's mine!
That totally crazy and mad woman is a character called Margot Shelby from the 1946 American film noir Decoy, directed by Jack Bernhardt and starring Gene Gilly as the Margot. She was a wife of the director, Jack Bernard. And Jack Bernard brought her from the UK to America in order to make her a big star. They kind of separated about a year after this movie was made. She went back to England to continue her acting career. And unfortunately, at the age of 33, a year or so later, died of pneumonia. But the one thing she has left behind is this totally ruthless, selfish, insane, and ultimate femme fatale character, Margot Shelby, in this tiny little movie. Margot was a girlfriend of a gangster, Frank Ollins, played by Robert Armstrong from King Kong. He's the guy that says, "'Twas beauty killed the beast in King Kong." He's in jail and has several hundred thousand dollars stashed away and won't tell anybody where it is. Margot's problem is that Frank is about to be executed in the gas chamber and hasn't told anybody where the money is. So she hatches a plan to have him brought back to life after he dies in the gas chamber using a chemical that counteracts the effects of cyanide poisoning, which is a real thing, but it can't bring people back to life after they die of cyanide poisoning. So there's a slight science fiction aspect to this. The doctor she gets to help her with this is Dr. Lloyd Craig, played by an actor called Herbert Rutley, who you'll recognise him by his look, but you won't actually know the name, probably. There's also a copper involved, played by somebody who we know from a number of things, Sheldon Leonard. He, of course, was famous for playing gangsters, and he plays Sergeant Joe Portugal, who's a cop. And probably some of the best bits of business in this movie are by Sheldon Leonard. He later went on to be a producer. He produced the Danny Thomas Show on television. He was the producer for I Spy, the TV series with Robert Culp and Bill Cosby. And he was also the voice of King Leonardo in the King Leonardo cartoon series in the 1960s. Very distinctive voice. In this one, he gets some nice bits of business playing a cop rather than a bad guy. And he is there right at the end of the movie. And there's a wonderful scene between him and Margot, which is one of the kind of wow scenes of film noir anywhere. I'm not going to spoil it for you because you've got to track this one down and see it. Maybe a little bit hard to find because it's very much a C picture. As I said, it was a monogram picture. It's only 76 minutes, so it doesn't outstay its welcome at all. But as I said, the basic plot is that they've got to get Frank Collins out of jail and have him tell them where the money is stashed. Margot has a boyfriend. She's playing along for things, played by a guy called Edward Norris, character called Jim Vincent, who's the kind of good-looking love interest for Margot, though. The interesting thing about Margot in this movie is she doesn't care for anybody. She'll use men left, right, and centre, and because she is attractive and sexy, and the implication being, of course, that she's willing to put out, she can manipulate men. There's a little bit of a backstory to her, that she came from a very poor part of the UK during the Depression and has decided that she wants to make money and never wants to go back to being poor again. And so she uses that as a justification for treating everybody else like a piece of shit. The movie starts really interestingly, and Jack Bernard does a really nice bit of work here. Crazy low budget on this film, remember. There was very little money. There are things like elevators in apartment buildings that are just clearly just sliding doors, but it gives it an almost kind of abstract look at times, which works for the film. But the movie starts in a really filthy sink with a tap in it in a gas station way out in the sticks away from the city. So you see the sink, and you see a guy with bloodstained hands washing his hands in the sink. It turns out that this is Dr. Lloyd Craig, and that he's been wounded by somebody, and he's been left out in the sticks, and he's in this really rough-looking garage, and he's got to find his way back to Los Angeles for some reason. We don't know why at this stage, but we do see him make his way back into the city, make his way into an apartment, and shoot a woman. That woman is Margot. So we see then her talking to Sergeant Joe Portugal and telling the backstory of how they plotted to get Frank out of jail, how they managed to do it using the hospital Dr. Lloyd to do it, and how she betrayed everybody and how things eventually turned out. Now, Margot has the cash box with the money in it with her, but she hasn't had time to open it when Lloyd came in and shot her. So we get all the backstory. The whole movie is told in flashback except for the little bit at the start and a little bit at the end. So it really does run really strangely. You've got that Frankenstein aspect of resurrecting a dead man and taking the body away and not filling out an autopsy report and using these chemicals and blood transfusions to bring him back to life and to have him tell them where he's buried the money so that they can help him get back on his feet and hide his identity and get away, having escaped death by gas chamber from being resurrected. Of course, nobody thinks for a moment that this is going to happen, but he gives them a map of where the money is buried in a eucalyptus grove out in the sticks, and then Margot starts betraying everybody. And slowly she peels off the men as she doesn't need them and ends up killing them. She runs over one with a car. She shoots a couple and ultimately ends up being shot by Lloyd, who she's mortally wounded, but who has managed to survive long enough to come back to town and kill her. The reason you haven't heard about this movie and the reason why it doesn't have a lot more oxygen than it's been given is that for some reason after 1978 it rarely appeared on television or anywhere else. And in 2000 the American Cinematheque showed it with the writer of the original story Stanley Rubin there, but it really didn't gain much traction. It didn't have a big studio to promote it along and maybe get some sales of DVDs and Blu-rays out of it, but eventually it did get a DVD release, and it's definitely an amazing hidden gem of a film. As I said, it was low budget. It probably didn't have a very long production time, but it definitely hits the sweet spot of film noir. It's got a femme fatale. It's got flawed and vulnerable men. It's got betrayal. It has crime. It has prison. It's pretty much a kind of distilled essence done on the cheap of what a really good film noir is. It's got the most important aspect for me for a film noir in that it's imaginative and it's got a very memorable villain. And the villain of the piece has been rolled into the femme fatale. Everybody else around the three main characters, Jojo Portugal, the cop played by Sheldon Leonard, the character of the doctor played by Herbert Rutledge, and Jean Gillies Margot, everybody else is kind of extraneous. They're there to fulfill a certain role and then go away. Even Frank, who is the engine of the movie in the sense that he's the one who knows where the money is buried, isn't at the core of the film. And one of the other points this movie makes too is that Lloyd's a poor doctor. He's working out of a small office in a working class area where people can't pay very much money. And he's dedicated to his work. But along comes this woman, knocks him totally off his feet, manipulates him in the way that nobody in his life previously has. Yes, he does have a girlfriend, and there's always a good girl to balance out the femme fatale, so his nurse fulfills that role in the film. Again, it's only 78 minutes. It's not very long, and there's not a lot of time for a lot of the characters to be developed. But it's crazily effective at it in a really odd way. You kind of excuse the cheap sets and the fast pacing and how most of the movie is fairly studio-bound and the street scenes don't particularly look like streets. They're very clearly sets. And the fact that they don't have A-list actors or even B-list actors in the roles. Right at the heart of it, you've got this crazy performance by Jean Gillies where she plays at an almost hysterical pace some of the time. And her character, which somebody said in a Facebook group for film noir a little while ago, which is the one that introduced me to this film, Margot manipulates men in the same way that men manipulate women in so many movies. She's got almost masculine ruthlessness about her while being very feminine and quite attractive and kind of sexy. The odd thing about it is Jean Gilly plays it in such a way that you can understand why men go after her and are willing to do monstrous things in order to have her. Kind of got me thinking about femme fatales in real life in some ways. I've had a little bit of experience with women, I'll be really honest about that. And there are times in life when you meet the wrong woman. And there's a powerful attraction. You kind of go for it. You overlook certain aspects of them. You kind of are led by your dick somewhat. And you can get yourself into some really strange and deep trouble by what you think is following your heart, but isn't really. It's following almost something a lot more primitive and a lot more primal than love and romance and things like that. It's a little hard to describe if you haven't experienced it before, but I was talking with somebody at my birthday party, in fact, which was kind of interesting, and we were talking about a mutual person with whom both of us had relationships. And this person told me that the person I was talking about was a narcissist and loved the idea of people falling in love with her. And so she had a profound effect on both of our lives as a part of that. Neither of us have seen her for 10 years. But still, we went home and thought about this for a while, and it was a good conversation. It was really great to catch up. But I thought, yeah, femme fatale, they do exist in real life. There are people who manipulate. There are men who manipulate women sexually and romantically, and there are women who manipulate men sexually and romantically. It's a little bit at odds with the current Me Too movement and all of the horrible things that have happened with that. But there are people like that in real life. And seeing Decoy, not long after I had that really great conversation, and it's one of the best conversations I've had in a while because it talked about a shared experience of the same person in a sense, and how that person has not used us, but had misled us in the relationships in which we had with that person. Now, the odd thing is that I'm a guy, and the person with whom I had the conversation is a woman. So that makes it even more complicated. But yeah, femme fatales, interesting phenomenon. And having now fully realized after that conversation, after all these years, and after that conversation, I got a weird kind of karmic closure about it by realizing that, yeah, both of us were used by the same person. And that's kind of a weird thing. And it is the engine from which femme fatales and that particular plot line happens in film noir. So for me, watching Decoy, it was kind of, you know, there were parallels in my own life which made it slightly unusual. Maybe I'm seeing more into the film because of that. But I like it, and I do understand at a deep level the attraction of the wrong woman, femme fatale. And Margot in this particular movie is one of the great femmes fatales of film noir, and you've really got to see it. Look, don't expect too much of the film around it, but there's a great scene right at the end between Margot and Jojo the cop, with whom she'd been flirting for a while, which really nails her character and who she is right at the end of the film. And there's also another little plot twist there right at the end, which is not entirely unfamiliar to us, but seems apt for this particular film. I really liked this movie. It was a hidden gem for me. It was one that I didn't know about. And if you're interested in any genre of film, definitely tap into, particularly on Facebook, any groups you find that are specifically focused on that particular genre of film, because it's always going to lead you to places you've never been before. And the film noir Facebook group that I've become a part of is really a good source of that kind of material. They're fucking obsessive about them. But Decoy, definitely recommended. I'm going to have to try to find an original copy of it. The copy I got's a little bit subterranean. but I liked the film, and it's probably up there in maybe my top 10 or 15 films noir. Check it out. Anyway, I'm going to leave it there because, again, for some reason, my throat's getting a bit croaky. I do have a new Patreon subscriber too, so I'm going to do a shout-out to David Kummer. David and I met each other 20 years ago when I was in Minnesota, once upon a time when the world was young. And we kind of got back in touch with social media and our mutual acquaintances and friends in science fiction fandom. And David has become a Patreon subscriber of the podcast. He's not yet on the cast list at the end of the podcast, but I just wanted to do a quick shout-out and a hi to David and a thank you. He's good people, and if you see him around the social media traps, definitely friend David up. He's a bit grumpy, a bit curmudgeonly, but his heart's always in the right place. So that's about it for this time around. I'm going to leave you, as always, with the credits to honour the Patreon subscribers for the podcast. And I'm also going to leave you with a track by Ann Richards, a jazz singer from years gone by, a little bit upbeat, a little bit cool. I'll put that after the credits. But anyway, thank you for listening. Another Martian Drive-In podcast in less than a week. Another Paleo Cinema podcast in less than a fortnight. I apologise again for the delay in the podcast. When I finish this, I'm going to go to the gym and I'm going to start working on that YouTube vlog that I've done out at the Clunes Book Festival. So I'm starting to hone my chops as a film editor, which is going to be interesting. I'm sure I'm going to fuck things up, but it's a learning curve. Where anything creative, you don't get it right first time, but I'm going to give it a go. And I'll post on Facebook when that's up and running as well, and I'll post a link to that. So thank you again for listening. Take care of yourselves. I'll be back soon. And here now are the credits, followed by a cool jazz track just to see you off. Here are the credits for Paleo Cinema Podcast and Martian Drive-In Podcast, done in the style of film credits. I'd like to thank Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Claire, the script doctor, Gary, the prop master, Morris, our musical director, Jan, our dialect coach, Armin, our key grip, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Elaine, our scientific advisor, Julia, the casting director, Chris, the camera operator, Christopher, the gaffer, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Tansy, our foley artist, Alyssa, our location scout, Mark, the second unit director, Paul, the special makeup effects director, Tammy, the donut wrangler, Tim, our New York unit director, Steve, our spiritual advisor, Steve Sullivan, our script doctor, Dylan, the goat wrangler, Eric, the set security lead, Richard H., the set photographer, Mark D., the extra, David L., the extra, and Richard C., our transport co-captain, plus Andrew, our necessary film critic. We have Kerry H., our accountant, and Kerry L., our other spiritual advisor. Thank you so much to all the patrons for dipping into their pockets and helping out with the podcast. This has been a Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In production. The end.
Top, tell me why shouldn't I? You know what you are after. You're my lucky star. I'm on a rainbow rafter, climbing up to where you are. Oh, I'll have a time, it's a climb, but I'll make it, 'cause I'm shooting after. about you.